I would try to, like, you know, point them in a different direction, you know, and say, hey, look, man, like, these are the consequences that could, you know, you could end up in jail, or you could end up, you know, getting caught slipping in the wrong neighborhood, and you could get killed, you know, it could happen. And, but these kids don't listen, you know?
No, hell no, they don't listen unless you take their phone away from them.
This is the No Half Stepping Podcast. I'm Leonard Jackson. Real people, real issues, real conversations with no half stepping.
Go 3, 2, 1.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of No Half Stepping with Leonard Jackson. I'm your host, Leonard Jackson. We got a special, special guest host today, Alex Chow, ladies and gentlemen.
What's going on,
Alex,
everyone?
Tell everybody about yourself and so we can get this party started.
Yeah, short and sweet. That's what I like to do about it. Short and sweet. So one sentence, I'm a former hoodlum, former Marine officer, current victim rights advocate, lifelong learner, you know, and, you know, just to make sure you all understand, there's no ex-hoodlums, no ex-Marines. It just gets transferred. The energy just gets transferred. So shout out to all my econ majors. You know how it is. It gets transferred just like well, right?
He's not kidding when he says he had some hoodlum. This guy's a prominent attorney. He's, you know, he's a father. He's a husband. Like, he's, you would never guess that he had a hoodlum side to him. Can you touch on that a little bit, man, to let people kind of know how you got from that to where you are now, so to speak?
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, just made some bad decisions. Or good decisions, I guess. It depends on which side of the fence you're on. But, you know, made some off the path, off the beaten path kind of decisions. And, you know, just kind of rolled with it until, you know, I kind of grew up, realized that it was on me. My own success or failure was going to be on me. And, you know, and luckily I had some people around me that were supporting me at the time that was able to kind of prevent me from falling somewhere where I couldn't get myself out of. And, you know, I was able to kind of pick up the pieces and move on, you know. And in the end, it's all just like, I guess it's all my own perception of my place in the world. You probably read about it, right? It's the locus of control. What I realized, like, it was all on me. It wasn't external factors that were keeping me down. It was my own mentality, my own perception of the difference I can make in the world. When I realized that, you know what, it's all, you know, these are things that I could correct. These are things that, you know, I need to take a better look at and reflect in myself. Then I was able to kind of make differences and just be a better person overall.
And I talk about this with a lot of people about some people don't have those mentors that you just referenced. Some people don't have a mom and dad or just a big brother, or somebody could look out for them. When you look at people in the inner cities or these disadvantaged areas, and, you know, they could probably do just as well as you have or as well as I have, but they don't have that person that said, hey, man, don't worry about it. Just, you know, you can still do this, or hey, you know, oh, you got a B? Good job, man. Let's get that A next time. You know, you got what it takes to be successful. They're not hearing that at all.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, they're hearing just the opposite. Hey, man, why are you struggling, man? Why don't you sell some dope, you know, get you some new Jordans? I'm just telling you, that's what they're hearing. And that's the problem. You know, we talked about homelessness. Obviously, that's a little bit different because now you got drugs involved. You got mental health involved. People like you, people, because, hey, I ain't going to lie to you. My childhood, I've gotten in some trouble, too. But I did have support.
Yeah.
So I think that's one thing that we could be very thankful for, having that. A lot of people don't.
For sure. I mean, without support, your chances of being able to get out from whatever hole you're in is almost impossible, right? It's not about money. It's not about housing. It's about support, right? And support really comes in the form of other people, right? If you don't have people around you for you to want to make a change in your life, I mean,
is that what you do? Is, you mentioned something earlier, a people's advocate or something. Is that kind of what you do, is give that support that we're talking about?
Well, I mean, in terms of my professional life, I'm a victim rights advocate, right? So as an attorney, I mean, that's basically what I do for a living. But, you know, on another front, like we were talking about homelessness yesterday, you know, I'm involved with some of the neighborhood councils And a lot of our issues, and really it's the issues of LA, right, is dealing with homelessness, unhoused individuals, trying to figure out what's the best way to give them outreach, what's the best way to get them out of that, you know, cycle of addiction, poverty, mental health issues. And unfortunately, there's no easy answer to that. And obviously, right? I mean, if you're in LA, or if even if you're not in LA, you hear about LA's problems. I mean, we're the capital of homelessness. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, without
the weather.
Well, the weather is one. I mean, obviously we have legalized marijuana, so people come out here, but I think most of it is because of these communities have been built up, right? There's a huge homeless community. And so there's people from all these other states that come here because, you know, we have laws that kind of, you know, favor encampments and keeping people on the streets and allowing them to live their lives on the streets, which for most people, that's a dangerous proposition, right? Living on the streets is not a humane way of letting people live, right? Like, you can't just say, here's an encampment. Oh, I'm just going to let you do whatever and not help you. That's not humane just to leave people alone in that kind of position. But, you know, like the article I sent you, I don't know if you had a chance to read it. You know, that was a kind of something that opened my eyes to, you know, how drugs impact homelessness. Now, I mean, we know, most people know that they kind of went hand in hand anyways, but that article, and just some people may not know what article I'm talking about. There was some article that was given to me by a law enforcement friend of mine. And it was a chemist from the DEA who was basically breaking down how he saw the evolution of methamphetamine production.
Right.
So he was basically saying, you know, in the past, methamphetamines were made with ephedrine, right? And then obviously, you know, the country, the states, even internationally, they really cut down on the ephedrine availability, right? So you can't just go to the store and just get it now, right? It's all like prescription based.
You used to be able to go to the gas station to get that, if I'm not mistaken, right? Like, help you stay awake. Yeah, I remember that.
And that's the problem, right? It was too accessible, and then people were buying it, making meth. So when they got rid of ephedrine, I guess there was another method of producing methamphetamine. They call it P2P. But it was kind of like a cheaper way of making it and a more low-end way of making it. It's like you're using all these household chemicals, all this nasty stuff. But the meth that they made through the P2P process was inferior because there was two types of meth that they were creating. One was called like L methamphetamine. The other one is D methamphetamine. And apparently L methamphetamine really had no impact in terms of the person getting high. So, but there was no way to separate those two, right? So the end product had both D and L meth. But what this chemist was saying was that he was testing the meth currently on the streets, and he was testing some of the meth that they had taken from these meth labs in Mexico. And he was finding that it was like all D methamphetamine. It was all the actual methamphetamine that was actually getting people high. Somehow they found a way to take out the L methamphetamine. He didn't know which method they were using, but he knows that they were doing it. So now basically they're making cheap meth that has a kind of a higher potency than, you know, in the past, right? So he's saying that that's a huge contribution or a huge contributor to people being out in the streets, being, you know, drug dependent, having mental health issues.
Is meth worse? I don't want to use worse, but I guess it's worse than like crack, because crack would mess people up pretty severely. But I'm hearing people are dying from meth. They lose their minds on meth. Their teeth go bad on meth. Like, how bad is this stuff? Seriously.
You know, I don't know the comparison on that, but, you know, I think it just goes in trends, right? Like, obviously, crack was around for a period of time in the 80s, but then the kind of the message gets out there, right? Like, don't mess around with crack. It could be highly addictive. You know, you'll get caught in this vicious cycle of addiction. So then the trend starts to go away. Meth, it was strong in the 90s, and then it kind of cycled away. But I think right now, why we're seeing a resurgence of meth might be because of this cheaper, more potent form of meth, right? And, you know, I wasn't aware of that. My buddy who sent me the article, he's in law enforcement. He's been in law enforcement for like 20 some years. He wasn't aware of that. So,
you know, what's interesting? Crack was in the hood mostly, but meth seems like it's out there I don't know how to say it, I guess, with the hillbillies, the whites. I don't know. I don't know how to say it.
We're going to have to cut this out and post.
I try to say it PC, proper.
Yeah, you know, the P2P
method. It's not the ghetto is what I'm saying. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think the P2P method of making methamphetamine, I think it was created, or credit is given to the Hell's Angels for actually making that process popular. So I think their distribution channels just happened to be more in areas that were, you know, in the Midwest that had maybe less diversity. And then when, in terms of crack, I think, you know, I think everyone knows by now crack, there was some level of, well, there's intentional targeting of certain communities by unknown players. You know, I'm not going to weigh in on, you know, who, I mean, you're saying the government, and I've seen some conspiracy things, but I think largely it was the people who are creating the drugs, distributing the drugs, getting them into the pipeline. They were creating specific targets of where their biggest audiences were going to be. Right. So,
got it. So I guess fentanyl is on the same track of meth, I think, in terms of the communities that it's affecting.
You know, fentanyl is an opiate, and there's medical uses for opiates that obviously meth and cocaine don't have. So fentanyl and all the opiates definitely have another pipeline. They have a different distribution channel, and their kind of path into the streets, I think, is very different.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome Jace to the program. What's up, Jace? How you doing, man?
What's up, guys? How you guys doing?
Good. Doing great.
I've known Jace for a while now, and, you know, he's from the 818. He's been a tagger, or more, you know, formally a street graffiti artist for, what, going on 30 years now, since 92. You know, he's bombed trains, buildings, park benches, street signs, public, private restrooms, billboards. And when I say bombing, I mean, you know, they're tagging, not actually like bombing stuff. So, yeah, he's worldwide and franchised.
So, yeah, man, I've heard some really cool stuff. I've, you know, when he was talking about you bombing these things, I thought about Crush Groove and Beat Street.
I mean, that's where it started, yeah.
It started in New York. Then everything starts in New York, man. I'm not too happy about that. I'm an L.A. kid, but breakdancing, all that stuff started out there in New York. So,
yeah, I write J's. I'm from J4F, ICR Crews. Got into graffiti early on, probably it was ninth grade. I had a few friends that were already, you know, doing it for about a year. But, you know, in junior high, I was like really stuck on music, and I was trying to like play bass, and I was listening to metal, and, you know, in that whole phase. And then it's kind of, I think in high school, just seeing my friends just, you know, during recess and at lunch, they'd be just practicing their stuff on paper. And I've always kind of been like a letterhead. Like, I've always wanted to have like neat handwriting, and like letters have always just interested me, you know, like, you know, old English fonts. So seeing them do that, and also on top of, you know, a few friends, one of them was like super talented. Like, he was already a sick artist. So it's like, he doesn't even have to try. He would just scribble on paper and be like, hey, let's come up with a name for you, and just like scribble stuff. And it just started from there. But I would say before I even really got to, you know, going out in the streets and doing it in the streets, when I was like 15, 16, I joined a gang. So I kind of have like this gap where I had to kind of put graffiti aside, because back then, you know, you're either doing one or the other, you know. I mean, you had your tag bangers, but it's like, it's kind of like once you move on to a gang, it's like you kind of graduated. So, you know, and also none of my homies from the neighborhood were like, you know, okay with the graffiti side anyway. So I just kind of left it alone for a while. And then early 2000s, it kind of came back into my life. So, and then from there, I went on a nice little run. And
you got out of the gang, it sounds like. I mean, I grew up in the 80s. And I remember Crips and Bloods. I mean, I had a Jerry Curl. I had the Raiders hat. I thought I was one of them dudes, but I never really got down. But I remember when I left, my dad took us out because he was afraid of I was going to join a gang. But I would call home, and a lot of my friends would just get caught up in it, and some of them got killed. But I remember it wasn't too easy to get out. Was it pretty easy to get out? Or?
Well, that's the thing, is I never got out. You know, it's like, it's kind of, you know, I was like in my mid-20s, and I was trying to, you know, I was making a legit attempt for the first time in my life to kind of get some things together and stop getting into so much trouble, you know? And, you know, the homies from the neighborhood were you know, they didn't seem to have a problem with it. It was because it was just kind of like a gradual process. Like around 04, 05, it was like hanging out with some friends. I got introduced to a big homie Triggs. And so we'd just be like always partying out in Hollywood and downtown. And, you know, late night after the bars, you know, come out of the bars, you know, some of the homies, as soon as someone breaks out a marker or a can, it's just kind of on after that, you know. So I'd be like, hey, let me see that. So I'll catch a tag and then started off with a little tag here and there. And then I'd say over the next couple of years, it just started picking up. And then I don't know, maybe around 07, 08, I just kind of went all in. And I just went on like a nice, like eight to nine year run where it was just, I just kind of went for it, you know?
So when y'all are tagging, you don't think the cops chase y'all down or is that never
again? I mean, there's different ways to do it. If it's 2 a.m. and you're with a couple of homies and you guys are wasted, like no one's really doing a good job looking out for each other. And it's just kind of like, it's like, you know, if we get unlucky, we get caught. But typically, if you're really about it, you're going to plan out your stuff. You know, if you have a certain spot you want to get, like a certain wall or a certain building, you're going to plan it out and you're going to have a lookout. And it's always good to have a good riding partner that you trust, that you guys look out for each other, you know, so you take turns. Like, I'll go first, you look out. If you see a cop or anything, you know, you signal and then, you know.
Do they arrest you if they catch you?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. I mean, if you're a little kid, you're catching a little tag, you might just get a slap on the wrist. And they'll be like, hey, get out of here, you know. But typically, like if you're if you got paint, you know, and you're actually doing some big things on a building or something, yeah, you're going to get arrested. Yeah.
Nowadays, they probably just let you go, you know. They're not even arresting people for like breaking in people's homes. So
yeah, I mean, there was one time, it was like 3 or 4 years ago, I was painting a spot and my friend was looking out and it was just typical, like we was right off of Melrose and we came out of a bar and like we were a little tipsy, you know. And then my friend had some paint, so I was like, oh, let me just catch this little wall real quick. And he signaled, but I was a little, you know, I was a little drunk, so I kind of reacted a little too late. So the cop actually drove by while I was still painting. And I don't know if he didn't see me and just kept driving or if he saw me and didn't care, but he kept going. So we were just kind of like, you know, like
J4F, you were talking about your affiliation, J4F. What does that stand for?
Just for fun, just for fame, joints, 40s, freeways, you know.
And what's ICR?
ICR is a old school crew from like early 90s, inner city rebels. I'm Crown Royalty. Tons of meetings. Yeah.
Hey, let me ask you, back in 92, were you hitting them J's? Jazer?
Yeah, well, my first name was Beer, B-E-I-R, but it turned out that there was a dude that wrote Peer, and my name was just, back then it was like, that was kind of a thing, was like, if your name's too close to another like writer's name, and that writer was actually established, then you would either have to like battle him for the name, or you might get caught slipping, he might beat you up and, you know, tell you to change your name. I don't know, it's just like, there's... But I ended up having to change my name. You know, I was a little kid and this dude was like 17, 18 years old already. Like he had a name. And so I changed it to Jay's then, which was my other friend's old name because he left that name behind to change it to Dense. So he's like, you can have my old name. So he just gave me his name, you know.
How do you battle?
It's just in the streets. It's just it's like you can pick like a certain like area from this street to this street, this street to this street. And it's just, you know, who can get up the most, right? So it's like, maybe they'll set like for like this next week from like this day to this day, like we're going to battle, you know, or like, and the streets decide, you know, like people are going to see who's up more and you'll know by the end, you know?
And you talking about art wise, who has the most?
No, I mean like who can get up the most, like who can get the most spots, like the most tags, the most throw ups, the most burners, you know what I mean? Like,
Got it.
Who can be the most productive in that time, you know?
It's like a dance battle, but with hit-ups, right?
Yeah, I guess, like, yeah, kind of.
The audience
yeah.
decides, right? Hey, so besides J4F and ICR, what are the biggest crews around right now?
I mean, the biggest ones are the same ones that have kind of been around. I mean, it's like MTA, you got OTR. These are old-school crews, you know? They're like, they're never going to go away, you know? They're always like in the top, you know, in the top five. I mean, as far as LA scene, and then Valley Crews, you got BN Dub right now that are killing it. They're like, I mean, they've been around for a while, but I'd say about 20 years now. They're really like, they've put themselves in the top five. RK's in the Valley. I mean, there's so many crews, and graffiti's become kind of, you know, more commercialized. It's a little more accepted than it was back in the 90s. So It's not just a certain type of person that's doing, you got all kinds of kids trying to do graffiti now, you know, like you can run into a writer and they don't even look like a writer, you know, just looks like a regular dude.
I'm surprised the city hasn't like made areas for people to tag, you know, like they did for skate parks, like skateboarders, like, oh, don't skateboard here, don't skateboard there. Then they just ended up making skate parks. Do they not have
like yards or like,
yeah, I mean, where
there, they can there just... are, there's a few legal, there's a, what is it called? I mean, well, the Venice walls are legal. The Venice walls are run by an old school graffiti crew. It's run by STP. And I mean, you can go there, paint for free, and it's, you know, you're not going to get in trouble as long as you throw away your stuff and you're respectful and, you know, no one's going to mess with you. You can go there unless you run into someone you have beef with over there, you know, then that could be a problem. But
is there a lot of violence in that whole world?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's rules like you can't just go over someone else. I mean, there's rules like so like bombs over tags. So it's like if I catch a tag on a wall and someone doesn't throw up over my tag, which is like, you know, like let's say it's a white fill in with a black outline. So they'll come in, they'll outline it in white, fill it in with white, outline it in black. So it's just like it's a throw up. That's OK. Like they're allowed to do that. But if someone does a throw up over my throw up for no reason, then that's beef right there, you know.
Now the beef doesn't escalate to guns. It
can.
Yeah.
I mean, there's people that have gotten shot and killed, you know, like for sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't think it happens all the time, but it happens, you know,
it happens. Wow. Yeah. I know it's like that.
And especially if you're painting in like a neighborhood that like certain hoods still are really anti-graffiti, like they don't want taggers in their neighborhood. And then if you're in there and they catch you slipping, they're going to fuck you up, dude. You know?
Hey, what are the hoods? Hey, what are the hoods that are like anti-graffiti right now or like no graffiti zones?
I would say a lot of the old school, like a lot of the old school Chicano neighborhoods in like Northeast LA and LA still kind of, you know, go by the whole, like, you know, no tagging in our neighborhood. You know, I know my homie Brace, you know, RIP Brace, he passed away in 2013, but he grew up in El Sereno neighborhood in Northeast LA. And I know they're very strict about, like, when you drive through their neighborhood, you don't really see any graffiti at all because they regulate that shit, you know?
Right off the 101, like at Western, like you see some of the same stuff, right? Like there's not too much hit-ups, right? Because that's all like MS territory. And,
Oh no, but people still, I mean,
no, people hit up, but just the other day I saw somebody like somebody did a tag and then somebody crossed it out and they put MS and it was like, you're going to fucking like, we're going to fucking kill you or something like that, you know?
Probably. Yeah. Writers these days, if you're a writer coming up from like from a bad neighborhood, like you'd be surprised. There's more, a lot of these more youngsters are strapped up than I would say back in the 90s. That's for sure. Like, I mean, it's like back in the 90s, if you were like with your homies, there's like seven or eight of you, maybe one or two of you might be strapped, you know, like maybe. But these days it's like there's seven, eight, maybe half of them are strapped, you know, like probably half of them are strapped, you know.
That's crazy. Is there a way to make a living at this? Like at some point you want to, you know, make money and earn a living. Like
there's tons of writers that eventually went the legal route, whether it's doing murals, commissioned murals, or you know, just selling their artwork on canvases, you know, like, and then they'll do an art show.
See, that's dope.
Yeah. Like they'll do an art show just like a professional artist, you know, they'll do it and then they'll have their like, exhibit run for like a month or whatever. And I mean, Alex, you heard of like, you know, I mean, a lot of the MSKs, you know, they were able to, you know, make a career out of this shit, you know? So.
Hey, is MSK still around?
You know, they're not really I mean, you don't see them really up anymore. It's like, I don't think a lot of them are active anymore, but every now and then you'll see like an MSK tag or like a spot here and there. I'm sure there's other states where they might be more active, but in LA right now, I don't really see them up, you know?
People in LA, you probably have seen all these crews, right? Because they hit up like OTR and MTA are all over LA. So you probably have seen those three letters hit up all over the place, downtown LA and all the areas in the LA basin area. MSK was huge, like back in the 90s, it was everywhere, you know? And a lot of those guys transitioned, just like you were saying, Leonard. A lot of those guys started doing legitimate actual commercial artists, right? And then some of them became tattoo artists. And I actually have some work from Keen from MSK back in the day. He's a tattoo artist. I mean, he's pretty big in the tattoo scene now. you know, so there's ways obviously of transitioning. I think he actually, I think after he became a, like after the whole graffiti thing, he was doing a like actual commercial, like studio art. Like he was drawing like for animation, some kind of animation thing before he became a tattoo artist. So, I mean, there are obviously ways to transition. Some of these guys out there, I mean, they're really actually really talented, you know?
So James, are you currently still tagging? Or have you started being, doing exhibits?
No, I mean, I don't think, I mean, well, one, I never really considered myself an artist. It literally took me 20 years to be able to just like, you know, put up a decent tag and a decent throw up. So it's like, I can do my letters, but I mean, as far as like just being able to just get down and do some like freehand art and like, yeah, that's just not me. So I never really.
Are you working like a desk job now?
Well, I mean, let's say I do, I'm in the home improvement industry. So without getting into too specific, but I have a career and, you know, I have a daughter. I'm, you know.
Hey, congrats.
I single dad. So I got to, you know, I got to handle my stuff at home too. And so I have responsibilities now. I can't just be out there just risking that shit for, you know.
No, man, you're they call a survivor. You know, a lot of people can't say what you just said. So I applaud you for that. You know, before you came on, Alex and I were just talking about, you know, I would consider myself one of the lucky ones. And I don't know about you, but, you know, we made some not so great decisions coming up. And thank God we're here to have these type of conversations. You know what I mean? I tell people this story all the time. A buddy of mine and I drove upstate New York from Atlanta to pick up my brother from college. And he's my buddy's Colombian, but I didn't think of anything about it. So he's like, hey, man, you're going to go to New York? Hey, I want to go with you. I'm going to bring this TV for my aunt. I was like, yeah, that's fine, man. No problem. Don't worry about it. So we get to drop off the TV and he's like, okay, go. I was like, wait, why are you acting like that, man? Just go. Man, this dude had me take a whole thing of cocaine up to New York. That was 25 years ago. I could be just now getting out of jail.
Yeah.
Oh, you just admitted to a crime right now, Leonard.
I'm just kidding. Hey, let's edit this.
Hey, that's a good joke, though. That was a good joke.
Yeah,
it was
a great joke.
Hey, actually, Jace, you had mentioned something about Triggs, right? So I want to make sure that we can talk about Triggs a little bit because he was definitely somebody who was influential in the LA scene and actually even beyond the LA scene. So, I mean, before, you know, I was just wondering, hey, Leonard, have you ever been to like Supreme, the Supreme store on Fairfax?
You know, I think I've seen it. I think I have may have gone there once.
Okay, so that Fairfax district, you know, there's a whole bunch of stores. Like, there's the, like, the Bape shop, Supreme is there. There's all these, like, trendy brand stores there. Well, at the bottom, like, closer to, I think that's Beverly, there's a store called The Seventh Letter. And if you go into that store, it's a whole bunch of different shirts and other apparel and other merchandise that has art from some of these graffiti artists, right? Some well-known graffiti artists and whatnot. And was he one of the guys that started Seventh Letter?
No. It was some of the MSKs started Seventh Letter.
Okay.
Yeah, MSKs, AWRs. And then Triggs eventually got in MSK. And that's how he got in Seventh Letter. So... But yeah, it's all the OGs from MSK, they started Seventh Letter.
Yeah, I know you told me before though, but your kind of reemergence into the scene, right, was in some ways because of Triggs.
My good friend introduced me to him, I think it was like 04. And this is like when this is actually when he started going on his run. And he was really, I mean, it was like he was literally up everywhere. It was like you couldn't go to any part of LA and not see him up. It was like he was up everywhere and people started recognizing that shit. And, you know, that's how he eventually got on MSK. But for me, it was like, cause you know, like, even though, you know, I had that gap, you know, of not doing any graffiti, not even thinking about graffiti. I mean, it's not that I, you know, didn't like doing it anymore. I just, you know, I had to leave it behind. So it's like, once I got to a certain age, I'm like, God, think about it. Like, man, I wish I could just catch a tag, but I would tell myself I'm too old for it now. You know, it's like, I missed my moment, But then when you see Triggs, who he was in his like early 30s when I met him, and he was like killing it through his 30s, you know, and it was kind of like, well, if he can do it, I'm like, fuck it, I'm going to do it too then, you know, like I'm not too old. And then I started noticing other writers too coming out of retirement, you know, writers from like the early 90s, and, you know, they were coming out and doing shit again. So it's like, I mean, he kind of gave me the green light, and then he took a liking to me. And then in 07, he got caught for graffiti. So I think he was being, you know, watched for at least a few months. They built a case on him, and he ended up doing like 4 years for graffiti.
Whoa.
Yeah. He did prison time. Yeah. He did 4 years.
That's serious stuff, man.
So is graffiti and tagging, is that the same thing? Graffiti and tagging?
Yeah. I mean, like, like I would say graffiti and tagging is the same thing, but street art and graffiti and tagging is a little different. Like street art is like the, you know, people that we paste, and they're like artists that are, you know, putting up their stickers and we pasting. Like, that's not really like people like us writers, we don't consider that graffiti, you know, that's just street art.
Like you're talking about Obey.
I mean, hey, no disrespect to Shepard Fairey, but he's not a graffiti artist. You know, he's a street artist, you know?
So you got tagging, you have graffiti, and you have street art.
Yeah.
Is that correct? Okay. And you were doing street art.
No, like just straight vandalism, graffiti, you know?
Just straight vandalism. I like that. Vandalism.
Yeah, I love it.
I like the act of doing it, like the rush, the adrenaline rush, and then
and then
coming back around, driving back around, and kind of just, you know, feeling myself a little bit, looking at it like, oh, that was a good one right there. I like that one, you know?
And the whole world gets to see it, whether they like it or not.
Yeah.
What if there's a 10-year-old, 9-year-old kid came up to you and he's like, yo, man, I want to get in the game. What would you tell someone coming up trying to get into the tagging game?
I mean, I would definitely try to persuade him not to, but it's like, I mean, when you're like, I mean, just thinking back to when I was a kid, no one was going to tell me not to do it. I don't care if it was my, you know, older cousin, someone that I respected, that, you know, even if he sat me down, I mean, most of my family still don't know about this. So I would try to, like, you know, point them in a different direction, you know, and say, hey, look, man, like, these are the consequences that could, you know, you could end up in jail, or you could end up, you know, getting caught slipping in the wrong neighborhood, and you could get killed, you know, it could happen. But if these kids don't listen, you know?
No, hell no, they don't listen unless you take their phone away from them. Is there like a magic marker tag now?
Mean streaks, like solidified paint markers, that's a tool of choice.
They still use streaks?
Oh yeah, but now they're not mean streaks. Well, I mean, you can still get mean streaks, but now like there's a brand called Sakura where they're making them. It's like, they say it's not for graffiti, but they're making them for graffiti. You know, it's like we're the only ones that are buying these things.
But they're not tagging cars and stuff like a Tesla or nothing. They're just tagging buildings, right? Or,
well, I mean, most writers, I would say, you know, are respectful enough to not, you know, to not go right on a church or right on someone's private property. You know, keep it on buildings, keep it on, like, you know, signs, billboards, you know, freeways. But there are idiots out there that, you know, that make us look bad by doing dumb shit like that, by just going and fucking like, but a lot of times it's like these youngsters, kids that don't know what they're doing yet, and they'll just go and they'll just think they could just write on anything. But eventually I would say most writers learn, you know.
Are they mostly male, or are females getting in the game?
Mostly male, but there are female writers. We actually, we have one female writer in our crew, J4F.
One out of how many? How many guys though?
What, just LA? Or because, I mean, we have cliques in, like, we have Portland, and then we have heads in in Vegas. We got homies, like, not a direct connection, but like, and there's another J4F in Chicago that started around the early 90s also, and then we ended up finding out about each other. It's not like we started together, but we found out, and then we kind of were like, hey, you know, I mean, you guys are doing your thing out there, we're doing our thing out here, so we kind of
joined forces.
You know, we're cool in that, yeah.
So how many people nationwide, how many people you think, ballpark?
I'd say roughly like 100. It could be more, it could be less, but I would say at least 90 or 100. Because just in LA, we're like 30, 35 heads deep in LA. If you count everyone, like, you know, people like me that are not active but still in the crew, probably at least like 35 of us out here, yeah.
So if your daughter want to get in the game, you say, no way, Jose.
No way. Are you kidding me? Yeah, we might have to move. You know, we might have to leave the country for that one.
Hey, share a craziest bombing story that you ever, that you can remember right now.
Actually, there was one time me and Brace were painting on the tracks, and then I finished before him. So I was waiting for him. And then while he was finishing up, a homeless dude came up from behind us, and I was like, what the fuck is this guy want? You know? And then turned out he's from 18th Street, and he banged on us, and he was banging on us in Spanish. And then some Brace, you know, and him were having a quick conversation. And I was just like, oh fuck. And this fool had, you know, he had his hand under his sweater. And I'm like, oh. I'm like, yeah, this dude's homeless. I'm like, he's got nothing to lose. Like, but so it turned out he's basically just telling us like not to paint there, you know? So, we were like, you know, well, Brace was like, you know, telling him like, hey, you know, we're done, we're leaving, you know? So we started walking away, and I'm like, hey, what was he saying? He was like, oh, he was just pretty much telling us not to paint here. And he was like, if we come back, you know, we're going to get smoked. And, okay. I'm like, well, we're done anyways, let's go. So we were leaving. Coming off the tracks, we hit the corner because our other homie had just finished before me. So he was already walking back to the car. And I guess the cops were waiting for us out there. So as soon when we came around the corner, they already had him detained. And then we came around the corner to spotlight, and then boom, then we got popped. And so we got arrested.
You didn't make a run for it? What's up?
I mean, the spotlight was like, we didn't really have a chance to run. Yeah, it was like right there. It was on us. Like they were right there, you know. But I mean, yeah, we could have ran, but in that moment, we probably would have got caught if we ran, I think.
It probably would have been worse, eluding.
Yeah, yeah.
So that guy was packing, though. He was packing?
Yeah, I mean, he probably was. You know, I mean, it's not, we weren't trying to find out, you know, but I mean.
Like,
if he's gonna come up like that, I don't think he would just be, like, not have anything, you know? Maybe he had a knife, you know, at least, but. Yeah, I mean, there's been stories like that. I mean, a bunch of chases. You know, we've been painting. My boy stepped in shit one time, and we were like, it was like bum shit, you know? And then, you know, it's like, hey, you're going to have to leave your shoes. And he was like, dude, he's like, can I just stick my foot out the window? So we drove home for like 20 minutes, you know, with his foot hanging out the window. Just like funny, you know, funny things like that. You know, just weird shit happens all the time. When you're out that late at night,
yeah,
things happen, you know, like you see weird shit, you see crazy shit, you know.
Do you remember the day where you're like, you know what, I'm done, man. I just, you know, that moment where you're like, that's it for me.
So when Triggs got out of prison, he put me in charge of the crew because he was kind of trying to focus more on, because he was working on his own like clothing line and he was trying to work on his brand. So he put me in charge of the crew. And then it got to a certain point where I just, it wasn't fair. I wasn't doing a good job because I couldn't give 100% of my attention to the homies, you know, and to what was going on. So, because I mean, I just had too much other shit going on in my life. So just to be fair, I handed it off to my homie Sita, which is, he was like, to me, was the next man up. And so ever since then, he's been running the crew and he's doing a great job. And he's like, he's also an artist at heart. So he's taking his graffiti and he's doing, you know, t-shirts and, you know, album covers. I think he did a cover for Draco. You know Draco?
Yeah, no, I heard of it.
If our listeners want to go take a look at this art, where could they go? Where would they drive? Where would they?
Well, where are the best pieces? Where are the best throw-ups, you know? Like the Venice train tracks?
No, I think you're going to see the best stuff in the streets, you know? Like, as far as, like, throw-ups, like, if you want to see, like, the real shit, you just got to, I mean, you drive around downtown, you see it. It's, I mean, downtown is always getting crushed, you know? So, if you want to see, like the true essence of L.A. graffiti, and like, just drive through downtown, you know? Drive through Hollywood.
And how do we know what's your crew or what's somebody else's crew?
Well, you'll see the crew next to the name. You'll see J4F or ICR, or you'll see a big J4F bomb with the name of, you know, the right, you know, the homie that did the throw up, you know. Just drive around downtown. You'll see us. You'll see all the other crews I mentioned. We're all out there, you know.
To be fair, I want to make sure. You said Brace and Sita. Never heard those names from you before. But I see them up all the time. They are all over LA.
Yeah, Brace was when he passed away, he like still hadn't peaked yet. He was an up and coming artist, and he went to Cal Arts, and he was super talented. He did theater. Like, I mean, he was one of the ones in the crew that all the homies knew that like he was gonna actually do something for sure. You know,
what happened to him?
He got in a car accident. It was like super late night. I think it was like 3 or 4 in the morning. I'm not sure what he was doing. I'm assuming he might have been like, maybe he was painting and then he was either going home or going to a friend's house or something. But a big truck just kind of just smacked him. Like, I think he spun out on the freeway and just ended up kind of just, you know, like this. And a big truck just came and just took him out. Yeah. And then like 3 months later, Triggs got killed.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
What, somebody killed him or is it a car accident as well?
No, he got killed. He got shot.
But I mean, it was in the newspaper. It was on the news.
Yeah. Like, you know, just without going into too much detail, like, you know, he went next door to the smoke shop because, you know, so he ran a tattoo and a piercing shop in North Hollywood. And so every day he would go next door. It was the same owner, I think, that kind of ran both stores. And he would go over there to chop it up with them at the smoke shop, you know, late afternoons. And then he was over there, got into it with someone. They little physical altercation inside the shop. They got down and then ended up spilling out into the sidewalk. And the dude just pulled out a gun and shot him right there.
Come on, man.
That was broad daylight too.
It was like 4 p.m. or like 4 or 5 p.m. And then I was actually just about to get off work. And, you know, the homie called me like, hey, told me, hey, Triggs got shot. He's at the shop. So I left, picked him up. We went straight over there. And when we were pulling up, they already had the white sheet over him. And it was
come on, man.
Yeah, I see like the homies like standing around. Like, yeah, I was.
Hey, they ever catch the guy?
Yeah. He got caught. He ended up getting, I think, like it was like around 10 years, 2013. So he's actually going to be getting out soon.
10 years? He only got 10 years for that?
Yeah. So he's going to be out.
That's crazy.
I think he's going to be out in a couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, it's senseless. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, RIP Triggs. I mean, he was influential on the scene. I mean, obviously, he was all around LA too. You couldn't go down many streets downtown without seeing a throw up of Triggs.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just like to you, I mean, I'm sure he was a mentor, right, to a whole bunch of like graffiti artists and people. And also the fact that he also kind of parlayed that shit, right, into something legitimate, like the tattoo shop, doing his apparel thing.
He brought a lot of people together. He was like, you know, it's like, I mean, he was like covered. He was like tatted from head to toe, you know. So it's like at first glance, it's intimidating people. But like once you meet him. And if he's good with you, then, oh, like, you guys are good. Like, he's, like, a big bro to everybody. Like, he was, like, a big bro to all of us, you know? Like, and he brought so many different people into our crew. Like, if you look at pictures from us, like, around, like, 2011, 2012, like, group pictures, it's just, like, United Nations, you know? It's just, like, all kinds of different people coming from different backgrounds, like.
Well, he left a good legacy, it sounds like. If someone were to buy a massive warehouse and just put up a bunch of canvases, would a lot of people go there and do their art and maybe even have competition? I don't know. Just would that be something that would take off, you think?
If you're talking about like events or just having a spot that's just open from like 9 to 6 and you can just go there and paint or like pay to paint or
all of the above. Everything you just said, that all sounded great, actually.
I think any opportunity a writer can get to go paint and, you know, if they're, you know, to be able to, you know, do their stuff, they, you know, I think a lot of writers would be down for that, you know, like there's a lot of times you see festivals and art shows and events. Well, they'll set up canvases in the back and they'll let people paint. And, you know, it's like get in line because, you know, a lot of people are going to want to get up there and do it, you know, so.
Okay, we might have to talk.
The competition thing, that's new. I've never seen like a throw up competition, right? Like in the warehouse, right? On a fixed canvas.
I think that could bring back like an old school hip hop vibe again, you know, like make it like a competition with a prize at the end, maybe. I don't know, like something like that. You can win like a crate of paint.
A contract.
Or a contract.
And we were talking about it. Some of the old school cats are coming out too, right? Like Chaka, right? You remember Chaka? Leonard, do you remember Chaka, right? From the 80s, the guy, he just hit every, he basically wrote on everything. Everything that you could write on, he wrote on.
There was a commercial, like a Modelo or something that featured one of these guys. I don't know if you guys remember seeing it.
Cartoon.
Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Cartoon. Yeah, I saw that. Like, I saw it was like 2 days ago. I saw that commercial.
Is he a writer? I thought he's a tattoo artist.
He's a tattoo artist, but I mean, his background, you know, he's an old school gangster, you know. So, but I mean, he'll mess with paint, and he does murals, and you know, and he does his stuff like not in the streets, but Yeah, the commercial you show him, he's painting a little bit, and you can see he's in a warehouse. There's a bunch of artwork behind him. Yeah.
Yeah. Dude, one last thing I'll say before we wrap it up. There was a place I went to visit, and they have this massive wall. I think it was old construction, like a torn down bridge or something. And they would let people just tag that sucker up, and people would come. People would literally come from everywhere to look at.
Hey, so, I mean, before we close out, I just want to say, you know, like, we appreciate your time. Obviously, we appreciate your art as a city, right? I mean, from one certain perspective, you guys are beautifying the city, right? You guys are at least the people who are doing it right. You know, I mean, I enjoy when I see a good piece. I'm like, hey, I enjoy it, you know?
It gives us character here in LA.
Is there any websites, any kind of like Twitter handles, Instagram pages, anything you want to shout out?
I would say mainly it would be probably Cita's page, because he's really like, his shit's really about to, I feel like. So you can find him on Instagram. I think he's still under Polo Cuddy. So if you just Google Polo Cuddy, it'll probably, like, the first link that pops up, it'll probably be his IG. P-O-L-O, like the clothing brand Polo, and then Cuddy, C-U-T-T-Y. I think he actually changed it to Fella Cuddy, but I mean, you can still find him through Polo Cuddy. But definitely shout out to all the homies from J4F, all the ICRs, you know, and to you guys, I appreciate you guys having me on. You know, so I'm always more than happy to come on and talk about graffiti, so.
Days, I just want to say this, man. I'm impressed with you. I'm impressed with how you articulate everything. I'm a dad, so you being a single dad, I take my hat off to you for that. So
yes,
yeah, it's a pleasure to meet you, man. And thank you very much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you guys, man. You guys have a good day.
Yeah, you too. Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, Alex, for our first co-host, No Half Steppin', this was pretty good, man. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the No Half Steppin' Podcast. I'm Leonard Jackson. This has been a Lab Bureau production in association with Leonard Jackson Incorporated. Produced by Sean McBride. Engineered, edited, and produced by Michael Green. Music by Quarks.